Hello, what's up, everybody? This is That's Not Metal, your weekly rock and metal podcast, and this is Hyper Blasts, where we cover all of the week's big news and releases and give you honest, unfiltered opinions about them. Last week was our massive January reviews episode, so go back and give that a listen if you haven't. We covered 8 of the most essential rock and metal records from this first month of the year, but this, as said, is Hyper Blast. And Jesus, this might be a long one. My name's Perrin Hayesh. Sam Dignon is here. We're also joined by Mr. Mark Sanderson again for his take on this week's news. There's some stuff we certainly need your thoughts on here, that's for sure. Sam, you've not been to any shows this week?
No, had a bit of a chill week.
Me neither. Mark, you did. Tell us about your evening the other day.
Last night, I wielded the power of the dragon. I went to see Twilight Force in the show spectacular of the year.
Hotly reviewed in our latest episode.
Stunning 10 out of 10 reviews from from my co-hosts. It was... So, I'd never seen a power metal band before, weirdly, considering how much I love power metal. And it's sort of a, like, deep end pick, like, of the first power metal band to see being Twilight Force is quite funny. It was insane. Like, I don't even know where to begin. I love Twilight Force. They have amazing songs, massive sing-along choruses. So that aspect was perfect. Actually, I just want to start off by saying I never really thought about how I acted at shows before, but I was just doing my thing in the crowd, and there was someone, like, really heavy metal looking guy looking at me like, huh, and then copying what I was doing, and then I realized the entire show I was doing the pop punk finger gun point. And I do that at every show, and I never had to think about
the
it before.
The Highlands of the Elder Dragon.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, mate, you got some school, you can finger gun to them.
Proper giving it for the Enchanted Dragon of Wisdom. And the heavy metal people around me thought that was quite funny. But yeah, the show itself, obviously, they dress like mages and wizards and elves.
I was going to say, your photos, I love the costumes. The lady with the horns, you know, that's what I want to be.
Yeah, they had a backing singer who was like a faun. Their keyboard player's like a mage, and he does his wizard voice between songs. And during the song Thunder Sword, the singer wielded a sword and just sort of swung it around a bit. It was epic.
You took a photo which looked a bit like the sword was like casting a rainbow out of it, which is the most Twilight Force thing you could possibly capture.
Yeah, it was incredibly powerful. Like, it was pantomime-esque at points. Like, at the end of Enchanted Dragon of Wisdom, the singer, there's like a proper high note that he needs to belt, and he kept going like, oh, hold on, guys, I need to... And the fucking bassist handed him a magical elixir, and he's like, oh, yes, this does the job.
Oh, excellent. Love
before
it.
The Flight of the Sapphire Dragon, the wizard behind the keys was like, oh, there's a dragon I see. The prophecy has foretold of a dragon, but I can't quite see what colour it is. Is it a black dragon? And the crowd's like, no, it's a sapphire dragon. He's like, oh, is it maybe a red dragon? No, it's a proper pantomime shit.
This sounds like a nightmare for so many people who are listening to this.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's such an acquired taste, but it is exactly my taste.
Yeah.
And again, you're packing the biggest choruses in the game. It was a wonderful, wonderful night.
Excellent stuff. This is the kind of news schedule that makes me glad we do it in its own show now, because we've really got it all here. We've got breakups, we've got big new music, we've got controversy, we've got beef, we've got festival news, and we've got some ridiculous on top of all that at the end as well. So, let's begin. Quite a number of bands have actually called it quits in the last few days, which we will rattle through, but most obviously and most sort of almost bizarrely in reception to it is that Panic at the Disco is apparently no more, with Brendan Urie dropping a statement largely pinning the decision on the fact that he is entering fatherhood and he wants to spend more time with his family. But after an upcoming European tour, that is going to be the end of Panic at the Disco, which is a 19-year, nearly 20-year career at this point. And I was quite amazed at how little sadness I saw for this.
It's the last 2 years or so have just completely... Like, I'm still... It's one of those things I've had trouble actually tracing what shifted with the feelings towards Panic at the Disco. But this is, honestly, the most elation I've seen at a band splitting possibly ever, like, in my timeline.
I haven't seen elation. I have seen I have seen a lot of, like, kind of bitter, sarcastic, I told you so sort of about it.
I've seen genuine people who are celebrating this, and I'm just like, just the whole thing is just a bit like, okay. Like, I mean, I've not been particularly fussed. I thought the last album was not good, and, like, you know, like, it didn't really bother me. But yeah, people celebrating this one more than I've seen ever.
It's bizarre. If this had happened after Pray for the Wicked came out, the exact opposite reaction would have happened, yeah. I reckon. It's such a bizarre, like, sudden shift in the public perception of an act that I don't understand anything about, like, the discourse or anything. Like, you all fucking loved Death of a Bachelor, and now you're acting
other thing, is the revisionist history sort of take on Panic at the Disco broke up in 2009. I'm like, you were all going crazy for every album they've done up until the latest one. Don't try and act like you weren't because you don't like Brendan Urie anymore. I've seen you all do it. Like.
Yeah, that's particularly odd for me, I guess, because I do not care about old, supposedly classic Panic at the Disco. I don't think it's aged very well at all. My Panic at the Disco fandom started on Death of a Bachelor, which I think is by far the best record, and then kind of waned off again on the material after that. You know, the newest album is completely sort of floated past our world, didn't it? And I saw, you know, some videos from this latest US tour where they were playing. They made the decision to play the entirety of that newest album in full and have kind of, you know, hits either side of it, and arenas full of people just on their phones for like 40 minutes straight or however long that record is while that's going on. So I don't know whether that's just inspired a complete apathy about them, but I do agree with you that there is some you haven't been decrying Panic at the Disco's existence since fucking the other guy left, you know.
Absolutely. So, and again, like, there are various sort of claims and stuff said about Brendan that, again, still, it's all a bit muddled to me. And, like, clearly, one of the previous members, there's beef there that they, you know, that's why I think a lot of people have kind of taken that side. But it's just, it was just one of those weird things to trace in how the perception just seemed to shift overnight at one point of, like, they're one of the most adored kind of bands and was sort of celebrating them headlining Reading Festival and moments like that. And to suddenly, everyone hates Brendan Urie.
Do you think there's any sort of, I don't know, because again, you compare this to other bands of the time, where of, you know, the sort of the pop punk emo boom of the kind of mid 2000s or whatever. Panic are one of the very biggest ones, even if before you look at their how they've cracked like the proper mainstream pop charts in the last few years, there will be loads of people for whom Panic at the Disco were their band in the way that Fall Out Boy were for people, or My Chemical Romance were for people, or Paramore were for people. And when you look at, you know, My Chemical Romance and Fall Out Boy who have gone away at various points in time, those bands maybe didn't release material beforehand. I mean, My Chemical Romance arguably did, not to the same extent, but that disconnected their fan base in such a way. But do you feel there's any chance of, I guess at some point, you know, a renewed Panic at the Disco kind of lease of life?
I hadn't considered that. Perhaps. What I thought was maybe in a couple of years we're going to get Brendan Urie solo. Like, after he's had a couple of years off, he might try restart that. But yeah, I could definitely see that because My Chemical Romance's last record was extremely divisive, and then it took a couple of years of them being away for the sort of, you know, feverish, I need MCR back to kick back in. So, yeah, I reckon so. And, you know, everyone's so obsessed with nostalgia that, you know, for the 20th anniversary of A Fever You Can't Sweat Out, people are going to be like, oh yeah, can you play that, please?
Yeah, something like that, maybe. I would almost imagine if this like the rifting, you know, the original lineup can work out their differences and all get back together. I think that's maybe be the only thing that would get everyone back on board with Panic at the Disco at this point. I don't know if just the like I said, the dislike I see towards Brendan Urie is so intense from certain people that I'm just, I don't know if anyone could actually would have that nostalgia for Panic at this point.
Yeah, I certainly think personal questions cloud that more than in earlier periods. But I do think it's, I mean, again, I personally, I don't necessarily feel any kind of one way or another about this breakup. They're not my band. They have one album in its totality that I would say is particularly great, but it's not the one from fucking forever ago where you're insisting that was the true version of the band. And I agree with you, Sam, there's a lot of revisionism going on in terms of people pretending that they've not been into stuff. So it, certainly one of the more bitterly bizarre kind of hiatus announcements from, you know, a really big notable act that I can remember. Blood Youth also have put out a statement saying that immediately, you know, all kind of cancellations going into effect, everything they got coming up, they are going to be going on hiatus. And the statement that was put out does have a certain there's a sadness to it, certainly, about kind of the maybe the state they're at as a band and kind of how they're feeling about where they are and why it's suddenly just having to come to an end. But Sam, what are your thoughts on Blood Youth here?
I mean, the pandemic cut the legs off this band completely. They are one of those bands who were kind of like, prior to the pandemic, when on that second album Stop, were really actually starting to kind of get a bit of momentum going and build it up. And then pandemic happens, after Cecil touring, they have that album ready, which is as it's about to be released, vocalist Kai announces he's leaving the band. So already that kind of rollout is stalled, and it just feels like they've not been able to get things going back then. The statement is written by the guitarist Chris, who he's been the driving force in Blood Youth, I think, creatively the whole time. And he just sounds kind of broken by the whole thing. Like, that it's just like, he didn't want it to go this way, but they, like, he can't just keep the band going at this point. And I'm like, I think it's a shame. Like I said, like, I know they've never been the most, like, creatively inspiring or best band, but they've been, like, always a kind of, like, solid UK band who were improving and building up something that is just not, like I say, circumstances that have happened around the world. They are one of the bands who just got hit by it and weren't able to essentially get back up.
Yeah, I was never a fan, but it's impossible to read that statement and not feel kind of bad for where they're at in this regard. And also Terrorizer, grindcore legends, have announced for another point in their history they are going to be breaking up. This is a bit of a weird one because Terrorizer, I was never quite sure what their sort of activity level was anyway, because they are one of the most vital bands in the history of grindcore and extreme music in that sense, but particularly for, you know, an album and a moment from 35 years ago and their you know, new material they release every now and again, they're not super consistently, doesn't seem to land with any much real furore. Pete Zandoval has announced that he's going to be putting his time and focus into I Am Morbid, which is his band that he's in with another ex-Morbid Angel member, David Vincent, and that's why Terrorizer is going to be going to end. But yeah, no more Terrorizer for at least now being. You've probably got to imagine that will be the final time that they disappear. There's a lot of new music that we need to talk about, and so let's get started on all of that. And we are going to start with The Excerpts, who are back. And they have released a single called Gimme. We have been long expecting Excerpts material. They have been talking for a long time about releasing an album. Sam, you were talking about them at one point, speaking of a supposed double album. I don't know if that is what is going to be on the cards that this thing will be from. It's not like we have a lot to really go on here, but fuck me. They've made a choice here, haven't they?
Yeah, so, I mean, I have the slight more context of, I've heard two other new songs played live that are nothing like this, but as a lead single, this is, it was a bit alarming, I guess.
Yeah, I The Excerpts are one of my favourite bands. We talked about it on the Summer Roulette. New Excerpts material has been something I've been sort of like feverishly anticipating since about 2019 when they said they were writing the record. And first play on this was, I don't want to say devastating, but it definitely wasn't pleasant. Like, I don't know what the... You know, bands are allowed to sound different and change their sound, but this is so ill-fitting. It just doesn't suit them at all.
Yeah, what... It sounds like they've discovered hyperpop, for a start, mm-hmm. which is mental. I mean, the production is one thing, which, to me, I just... Something like the excerpts, again, I was the one who picked Hold On To Your Heart when we did the Summer of Amber last year, and I think that album sounds so sumptuous, and it sounds like a really vintage, will stand the test of time forever kind of classic rock album, and this sounds like 5 years' time. I am never going to want to hear anything that sounds like this again. But the drum sound and everything, it's just like, please just take a step back. Like, this sounds like, thank God it's only a minute and a half long, because that's about as much as I can sort of stomach it. But, like, how far it even goes with, like, you know, the kind of auto-tuned, like, hyper-pop melody lines and stuff that are in the verses. It's really, like, fucking hell. Like, you've really thrown your all into this sound, which, again, you can admire. I agree that I don't know how fitting for the excerpts this is. It's like, You kind of were quite fun anyway. Like, you had your you know, personal downcast moments and everything, but it's not like you're lacking in joy on something like Hold On To Your Heart. And I didn't need you to, you know, get green hair and start producing your albums like this for you to feel in any way alive. It's kind of the opposite.
The whole thing has a bit of a whiff of, like, the Machine Gun Kelly and Youngblood to it. Like, that whole TikTok pop rock, pop punk kind of thing. It just all has a, like, a vibe of that, and it's a sound that I just find so just icky and just doesn't gel with me at all. And again, I adore the excerpts. They are one of the best bands in the UK and have been for years, and they've been a band who have been, like, so criminally overlooked that I'm like, if they're gonna go this route, because this is what is in demand right now, I can't really blame them, even if it doesn't fit their sound. But this was just, like, just a bit deflating.
Yeah, and, like, it doesn't... Nothing about it plays into their strength. What is the excerpt's strength? They're earnest, they're heart on sleeve, they write really big, anthemic songs. This is... There's nothing authentic about it. It's so fake-sounding.
I don't want to cast too much question over their authenticity in terms of wanting to do it. I'm sure that there is a certain excitement for them in making a shift like this. I do think Murray as a singer is one of, he's like arguably the defining kind of factor of their songwriting. I don't want to listen to Murray's voice like this. Like, he sounds annoying. Like that Bow Down like part in it, his voice just sounds mangled in this.
It's the chorus. The chorus is really what does it for me. It's the "give me that."
Yeah.
I was like, no, it sounds like try hard to me, and it really just doesn't work. I mean, if someone else was like, man, when You, Me at Six are writing better music than the excerpts, something's wrong. Like,
I do sincerely hope that the album is varied to a degree where there is stuff that is far away from what this is, and maybe inherently already it's not going to be their most consistent record because it's going to have this in it either way, but hopefully there will be things to draw out of it.
I think there will.
I'm never going to write off one of my favorite bands off of one song. Maybe it'll be like, you know, not the last Biffy Clyro record, the one before that, the lead single from that was the pop song. That's wank, but the rest of the record is perfect. So maybe it's like that. I don't know.
We will see. Ghost have released a new version of Spillways, the best song of 2022, as I sort of collectively probably would have agreed. But this version features Joe Elliott of Def Leppard on guest vocals. I just thought it was cool to follow in this regard, because Joe Elliott, like a year ago, when Impera was coming out, was like, oh my god, this is the best record I've heard in forever. And I don't know how long Ghost would be on his radar, but he had the sort of feel of someone who's just heard about this hot new band Ghost, and is like, oh my god, this is everything I want in a young band. And, you know, Def Leppard came up so much in the sort of Impera cycle about influence and stuff. So I think it's cool to just have heard that story and then, you know, 8-9 months later or something, receive the outcome of it. Like, oh, they've gotten together. Great. I'm not sure really how necessary it is.
It's no different. Fair play to Papa for, you know, doing an excellent Joe Elliott impersonation on the original version, clearly.
Joe Elliott, he's not a particularly powerhouse distinctive singer of that generation, right? And he slips into this so nondescriptly that I think if you were to play this in the background of, like, a gathering of people, you could probably get away with no one noticing it was a different version.
No, yeah, no. I stuck it on and for the first time and thought, oh, I wonder when Joe Elliott's bit is going to come in. And then the song ended and I was like, hold on a second.
it's the middle verse, isn't it? But he comes in and he just, like, very calmly does the job with no real kind of chutzpah. No. And then if he's in the choruses, he's, like, completely blended in to the mix. I mean, you know, Ghost they're not new at releasing new versions of songs to, you know, get renewed playlisting factor and all this kind of stuff. Look, a version with a new feature and stuff, they'll be very savvy in that regard, but there's nothing really here to remember.
Not really, no.
The best thing about this is I follow a lot of Ghost stans on Twitter, and they were all like, oh my god, there's rumblings from the Ghost camp, they're teasing something, maybe they're going to kill Cardinal Copia, blah blah blah, and instead it's Joe Elliott's here.
Well, I mean, it's better than that, because there were billboards or posts or something around, I think Hollywood, that had pictures of Papa, and for some reason, I don't even understand if this is what he was doing or not, but for some reason, the teaser text said, Jesus is coming, and I don't know whether that means Joe Elliott is the Messiah in this situation, or whether that will be leading on to something else that is as yet unreleased. I don't know. We've also got Jesus Peace have announced their new album, So Unknown. I mean,
that's what Jesus Is Coming must have been.
Oh, yeah,
about,
they must
really
have been. They must have been predicting the return of some of hardcore's finest sons. So Unknown, it's coming out in April. They've released a song called Gates of Horn. I was just pleased to see this because it feels like it's been quite quiet in the Jesus Peace camp of late. Like, they're very much, they were part of that, you know, hardcore school of kind of 2018, 2019. Yeah. But since COVID, haven't really heard a peep out of them, so I am glad to have more new music on the horizon for them and maybe a renewed sort of campaign for Jesus Peace.
I mean, this is actually the second single. They released a single about a month ago and did a collaboration with a fashion line where they did this really nice rugby jersey, and that was kind of what got Jesus Peace back on the sort of public conscious. And then, I mean, they're playing Outbreak, so I'm just kind of like, yep, give me this. I'm down for new Jesus Peace. This song, Gates of Horn, just sounds really hard and, like, intense and aggressive, so well down for it.
Yeah, we also are going to talk about the fact that former Glory Hammer frontman Angus McSix, I believe he must have changed his name for some, you know, copyrighty reasons or something, because the character of Angus McFife is who he plays. His real name is Thomas Winkler. He has been rebranded here as Angus McSix after he was released from the band last year, and he's announced a solo album called Angus McSix and the Sword of Power that's also going to be coming out in April. But this, I mean, Glory Hammer for a start, there's an elephant in the room here which is very much going to be addressed, but not necessarily something that we would be, right, in this week of all weeks when there's a lot to talk about, you know, this isn't the most exciting new single for us to really jump to, but Angus McSix, again, for the backstory here, Thomas Winkler, the singer, was released from Glory Hammer very shortly before those screenshots of the Glory Hammer group chat were released, which exposed a lot of the fucking awful language and stuff that was going on there that has since led a lot of people to completely drop Glory Hammer. Like, you know, they're not a band that we are going to be continuing to covering here. Thomas was not involved in those screenshots, and the fact that they appeared shortly after he was released from the band raises its own sort of questions about their origin, maybe. But there is, I don't know if he's entirely off the hook, because there's a certain degree of, for a while there, you were to some extent complicit, you know? You might not have been involved in the behaviour, we can't say that for sure, but you were certainly in the band knowing, if there was a group chat, while these things were going on. So, again, this album and him, sort of in a grey area. The reason we're talking about this is this song, Master of the Universe, is essentially a Glory Hammer diss track, isn't it?
I would guess so, yeah. This is the power metal diss track, like, taking shots at Glory Hammer, shooting from the hip.
It's so funny. Like, obviously there's one line that I assume we're going to talk about.
Is it, Glory left my hammer, but now I wield a sword?
It's a big sword. Going by the video, he has got a big sword.
The fabled Sword of Power, you know, much more epic, you know, we're all proud of him for wielding it now. Much better than a hammer. But even just small things, like, it starts with beginning upgrade and then ends with upgrade complete. He's upgraded from the hammer.
Yeah, I mean, the fascinating thing about this is it's still in universe and in narrative. Yeah. Because, like, here, the after the heroic death of Prince Angus, hope seemed to be fading for Scotland and the whole galaxy, but our mighty hero has fought his way back into the world of the living and presents as Angus McSix, the debut album Angus McSix and the Sword of Power. So, veil here in all that bullshit is obviously the idea that the death of Prince Angus was when he was kicked out of the band, but he's our hero, he's the guy from that camp who we're behind and rooting for, and he's coming back. So, his, you know, return and everything, it's still in character from what he was in Glory Hammer. He's not, you know, departed and started doing a fucking grunge record or something about his feelings and laying everything bare. It's still the same fucking narrative nonsense, but it's his own variant of the Glory Hammer mythos. Are there going to be, like, multiple timelines going on? Like, what? How do you deal with this?
Are we going to get the Space Dundee multiverse?
Yeah, this, like, is fucking it. I mean, the weirdest thing is, unless I have missed something in regards to where the Glory Hammer situation went, both of these appear to be on Napalm Records. The same record label.
I didn't realise Glory Hammer was still going. I thought they were done. What? Anyway,
no, they are still going. They replaced their singer. They made an apology that a lot of people didn't really value. And they've continued on, and they've continued to play sold-out shows and everything. But both of these records, both these acts even, are currently on the same fucking record label, even though there is clear snipes being made through the veil of, you know, the Angus McSix multiverse.
I just think it's so funny that this bloke, right, he's from Switzerland, but he's like, yeah, I'm still the Scotland guy,
I'm still,
I guess.
Scottish. It's only set in Scotland because Chris Bowles is from Scotland.
You know how, like,
take it to Switzerland.
You know how you got me on board with power metal because of Twilight Force and like that? This is where I'm kind of going, like, oh no, maybe I don't like power metal and all this is going on. Like, this is where, again, it's too dark for me. I mean, like, the song is not the worst power metal song.
No, it's decent. Like, it still sounds like, you know, what he was doing in that thing. I mean, it's, I am sympathetic to what you just said, but also at the same time, I am glad that we live in a universe where power metal beef exists.
Is this the escape the fate and falling in reverse of power metal?
Oh yeah, my, like, god.
Jesus. So, I mean, if you haven't heard Mouse of the Universe, like, it's a big daft fucking Glory Hammer kind of shoot off song.
It's a banger.
But listen to the lyrics and read everything about it, and it is fascinating. I do not know where the fuck this will go. And Metallica have also announced that they are going to be premiering 72 Seasons the night before its release in cinema. So if you can go along to get to that, you'll get to hear it in all of its glory there. They've also released a second single, which is called Screaming Suicide, and not something we usually cover, but it's Metallica. We'll make a quick exception. This song, I guess to a degree, it is the second single, and we've all had our burst of personality about Lux Aeterna, but this song dipped without a fucking trace amid, like, you know, Sleep Token songs, which is quite startling for Metallica, you know, 7-8 years, whatever, after their last music. Second single just vanishes. But I've seen some dismissiveness of, you know, Metallica and their relevance these days, which always happens. I am here to say that, you know, I fucking love Lux Aeterna. Genuinely excited me as a lead single. So with that in mind, from my perspective, Screaming Suicide is a bit of a dud by comparison.
You know what? Lux Aeterna, I love, obviously, it has that great vocal you can scream. I think riff-wise, Screaming Suicide, fucking whopper. Like, instrumentally, I might prefer this song. That hard rock riff, I love when Metallica do hard rock, that's a fucker of a riff, is it not?
I do not agree about this being musically superior. And the first thing is, the main thing is engine, right? Luxa Turner fucking goes. And like, this is still old school, right?
This so still
we,
goes?
We were... Not really. It's not really got any spark. Like, the direction, I like, you know, Metallica playing that old school stuff. It makes me happy. I don't think the riff or anything is bad. It's a fairly fun old school heavy metal type riff. But compare the speed and the pace and the electricity in the room that you can feel on Luxa Turner. This is like a cool 80s riff, and then it just kind of trails on for 5.5 minutes. I had no idea why it's that long, and this does not have the... This doesn't feel alive in the way that Luxa Turner does, which I think is the main difference.
I got to disagree with you there. I really like this song. It has, like, you know, I love Metallica. I love Metallica songs that have multiple solo sections. But I think that's the thing. Like, it does have maybe not as much life as Luxa Turner, but it does have sort of a, like, boosting, energetic, like, vigor and, you know... I don't want to say it's not uplifting, I can't think of a proper word, but it's quite like it's full of sparks compared to quite a dour lyrical content, and I think that's a cool contrast. And I think this is just another really good Metallica song, I think.
Yeah, I think it's decent. Like, I'm down with rock and roll Metallica on this album. I think it's a sound that sounds, it means they can still go as hard as they need to without sounding like they're like struggling to keep up or like trying to recapture something. It's just going to like, yeah, you know, elder kind of like hard rocking dudes, like rocking basically. And I think this song is good. I agree. It's not nearly as good as Luxa Turner. It doesn't have that just that engine, that just like propulsive drive that song has. But I'm like, it's still like a solid sort of follow up on that. And I'm down for the album if it's going to have this kind of just like quite classic sound to it.
It's very 6 out of 10. I think like Hetfield's great on it, but there's no real chorus. It's the kind of song that I don't really mind while it's on, but it's just a bit like a stock idea of a Metallica song. It doesn't feel like a single as much as it does like buried way in the second disc of, you know, double album, or like a Beyond Magnetic cut or something, which incidentally I'm quite fond of. But you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, that's fair.
I think the two singles together give you a kind of realistic idea of what to expect, because it's a double album like Hardwired. I didn't expect it to be fully, you know, at it the whole way through. There is a shared direction between these songs, certainly, with that kind of old school 80s metal feel. But in quality, I think we've got, you know, A Moth Into Flame and A Murder One in regards to how amped up the songs feel. Damnation have announced their first bands for 2023's event. 2022 was one of the most spoken about festivals of last year's calendar, so many eyes will be on this one, where they are again for a second year in the BEC Arena in Manchester. And this announcement, considering all of their highest end headline bands are not yet on this, I think this looks fucking great.
It's a real good start. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Amon-Ra at the top, and again, not one of your top end bands, but still at the top of this, you're going to go, yep, that's awesome. Like, that last Amon-Ra album was incredible. Ahab, again, even if I wasn't crazy about it, getting them for like a UK exclusive off the back of a new album, awesome. High Command's UK debut is the one that I look at on there, though, is go, hell yeah.
Yeah, like this is the full announcement. It's Amon-Ra, Ahab, Rotten Sound, Downfall of Gaia, High Command, Heriot, Strigoi, and Ashen Spire. And I look at that, and High Command's UK debut show is one of the ones that was announced from way ago, and I'm very glad to see that finally getting the chance to happen. Ahab, I have been waiting fucking nearly a decade to see that band, over a decade even, and they haven't been around here very often at all. So that after... There's a lot of recent T&M kind of representation in regards to Ahab, High Command, Ashen Spire. You know, there was a thread in the focus group a little while ago about like what are the albums that you got into the most kind of over the kind of Christmas period after we'd done our end of year list, and there was a lot of shouts in there for Ashen Spire, which I was really, really happy to see. So that is going to be fucking amazing. Yeah, this looks very, very good, and I'm sure they will have even more in the tank where that comes from sooner rather than later. We've also got I believe the final announcement for Slam Dunk, with their final bands added and these stage splits in there in all of their glory. This final announcement, to me, there's not a lot that's been added at the last minute here. I mean, like, great, Paris are on there again. You do need to mention Scene Queen.
Apparently, yeah, this is just my thing now. But I'm like, I will happily go watch Scene Queen. It's not the most exciting final announcement. Higher power, that's cool. Yeah, not a lot else. Very slam dunk the rest of it.
Yeah. But, what do you think about the stage splits and looking at the poster overall now it is the finished lineup?
I mean, my praise at the middle two stages on that, get them alternating, because if that's the case, if I could have a run that goes Menzinger's yellow card creeper,
yeah,
like I will be living my best life. Otherwise, you know, like you've got plenty of really good choices for headliners between Shikari, Creeper, Yellow Card, Malevolence headlining stage is fucking awesome. Like after that band and the sort of the rise they've had, them now going from like middle of the heavy stage last time they played to top of it. Wicked to see.
Yeah, that Malevolent stage, which is, you know, the heavy stage, is a bit in the middle where it just turns into, you know, We Came as Romans, Escape the Fate, Fit for a King. All right, you know, that's the, you've got to have that standard, not very good stuff at a slam dunk on the heavy stage.
Opening run on that stage.
But yeah, but like Malevolence at the top of it, but then, you know, opening it, you've got Harriet, Higher Power, Sea Space Cowboy, Dragged Under, Static Dress. There's quite a lot there that will certainly whet some appetite. So yeah, decent stuff. Overall, there are also a lot of rumours flying around at the moment in regards to rock at Glastonbury, because two of the world's biggest rock bands seem to have hinted or dropped that they are going to be appearing at Glastonbury. Whether they will or not is yet to be seen, but the bands in question are Guns N' Roses and the Red Hot Chili Peppers, because Flea in a tweet and Duff McKagan on his radio show both seemed to drop the idea that they could be at Glastonbury. I think the Guns N' Roses one looks a little more, there's a little more to go on there than the just Flea's Red Hot Chili Peppers tweet at the moment, which I am cool with, because I would rather watch a Guns N' Roses set on TV right now than a Red Hot Chili Peppers one. But thoughts about the potential of one, if not both, of those bands?
I mean, aren't Guns N' Roses doing like British Summer doing a big Hyde Park one?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if that's like, obviously Glastonbury's far enough away, like, I mean, I've seen the reunited Guns N' Roses time set and had a boring, miserable time watching it. I couldn't really care about that. And our feelings on Red Hot Chili Peppers have been made very clear on the end of year awards. So this, I'm just like, whatever.
I couldn't care less about Glastonbury, really. Like, I don't know who played this year or what. Like, sure, Guns N' Roses is cool. I'll watch that on iPlayer if they end up headlining. I wonder if it's Red Hot Chili Peppers, though.
Yes. Something that does need a moment of conversation that I wish we weren't having to talk about, because it just feels like this story, the more it goes on, the more fucking annoying questions have to be raised about how the world as a whole reacts to it. But Pantera, in the last few days, have been announced that they will not, in fact, be performing at the Rock Am Ring and Rock in the Park festivals in Germany, where they had been announced this summer. It has also been announced that a festival in Austria, since this, has also removed them from the bill. Who knows whether there will be more dominoes that fall in this regard. But the statement that was made by, you know, Rock Am Ring and these similar festivals is that it is down to Phil Anselmo's track record and past behaviour in regards to, I mean, you know what the fuck he's done, you know, his racist outbursts and those incidents. And so it has been decided that they were going to be removed from the bill. And this is so fucking confusing in terms of, can people please just decide how they feel on this and whether they are going to accept this to happen or not? Because if you say that you do not want Phil Anselmo performing at your festival, that is completely within your rights, and that is completely a decision that many, many people will appreciate and stand behind. I am finding it really annoying how many people out there and how many corporations, organizations, events, whatever, not just Pantera, but in general, lots of things, seem to be wading in, sticking their fucking nose in things, getting things wrong, and then having to do an about face about it after they get called out.
Why even book them? Like, it's
Why do it in the first place? This isn't new. You're doing it based on fucking, you know, Dime Bash from years ago and all of those, the track record of incidents in the past. I'm not saying they're not valid, quite the opposite, but I am saying you fucking knew about that when you booked him.
This is exactly it. This is not, you know, it's not a situation of, like, they've been booked, something's come out, they've been removed, you know? If that's the way events go, I kind of go, I get it. This one, I'm like, you knew this was a con. You knew, even outside of, you know, Phil's racism, Pantera Union has its own sort of set of controversies surrounding it as to, you know, is it the Pantera lineup? Whatever. Like, they knew all this going in, and they chose to book it because they wanted to sell tickets off of that name because, you know, it's a hot new union that people do want to see. We might not want to, but I'm sure there are lots of people out there who do want to see, so that will sell tickets. And now, and I gather it's because bands on the Rock-Am Ring and Rock-Am Park lineup have sort of said, we won't play if Pantera play.
Yeah.
And that's forced the hand a little bit, which again, you know, I guess that's fair enough. But at the same time, first of all, the organizers, the bookers, stuck their neck out and chose to book them. And are now trying to be like, we won't stand by his racist remarks. We're removing him. And I'm like, grow up.
Yeah, I mean,
grow a spine.
It has been, you know, it's been pointed out that, you know, particular Rock-Am Ring and those events take place in Nuremberg. And the idea of a guy who, you know, got caught doing a fucking Nazi salute at, you know, a live event and has a track history of those kind of behaviours, performing at Nuremberg has a particular kind of irony to it that maybe can't be overlooked. I wonder whether we're going to see maybe a bit of a Europe and America divide here, because no American festivals are going to be kicking Pantera off, you know, and they've just been announced, you know, like, they're going out on tour and Lamb of God are playing with them and stuff like that. Like, that's, the Pantera reunion seems to have been largely unquestioned in terms of the American industry, where places like Germany and Austria that maybe have more of a, you know, a direct history having to deal with the kind of behaviour that Phil Anselmo is associated with here, maybe we're going to see more of a divide in terms of places like that saying no to it. And maybe, again, in turn, maybe the American industry will have a bit of a hard time wrapping its head around that. But I agree, you know? I mean, another one, it reminds me of the Vector situation, where there were a couple of incidents recently where 70,000 Tons of Metal, the Cruise, booked Vector, who, if you do not know, were essentially dropped from kind of their position due to stuff that was raised around domestic violence cases in that band. And as soon as they were announced for 70,000 Tons of Metal, loads of people went, why the fuck are you booking like an abuser on your cruise? And days later, removed from the bill. And the same thing happened when Century Media signed them, and they went, we have signed Vector, we've announced our new, you know, one of the most critically acclaimed thrash metal bands of the last 15 years, and then fucking, it might have been hours later, Century Media had dropped Vector from the bill because of the stink that was raised about it. And I look at that and I go, you can't think you're going to get away with it and then be surprised when you have to. It makes you look worse having fucking, you know, plowed into it going like, oh yeah, we can get this past people, and then being caught out and having to pretend that you've only just learned about these fucking things. And I'm not saying, you know, that I think that is more embarrassing than this particular Pantera thing because of how, I don't know, the Pantera thing has kind of gotten by to a certain degree, but I find it so frustrating how many bookings / signings, whatever, across the board, and then subsequent, oh, people complained, and then we have to drop it. Like, make a fucking statement from the start.
Yeah, that is absolutely it. It's like, if police want to book Pantera at this point, I'm like, fine, whatever, I'm not going to watch it, but that's their choice. But if you're going to do that decision, you've got to then stick by it. And if you're going to not, if you want to stand against them, do it from the start. Don't then do it because you got called out again. And when people know going in that this is a problem, don't then try and act like, oh, we didn't realize or whatever. It's just daft.
Yeah, it's infuriating. Spirit Box have upgraded their UK tour that had long been sold out in fucking minutes, I imagine. They have announced a second London night. They've also added Loathe and Brand of Sacrifice as support acts, and some of the other venues have been upgraded. Manchester has been upgraded to the Victoria Warehouse, which I just saw Trivium play, the Victoria Warehouse. That's the level we're talking about there. What do you think of I mean, obviously that's fucking huge news, but also you grabbed a ticket for the second London night, haven't you?
I mean, I was kind of like, oh, they'll sell out Roundhouse, but they're not going to sell it out in a day. And then I was like, oh, less than a day and it's sold out. Well, I'll go next time. And one of the announcers, I was like, adding like Lover, I've sort of said, like, I'd like new Lover material, but they are a easy win as a support band for Spirit Box at this point. That's a good time. And then adding Brand of Sacrifice to open, that's what sold it for me, absolutely. But yeah, big, big things from this band. Like, that's about 5,000 tickets they're selling for London, essentially, across those two dates, if they sell the second one out. That's Brixton on their debut album, on their first UK proper tour. Doesn't happen. And again, like, with Spirit Box, having now seen it, I'm like, it is justified. They are, like, legitimately deserving of like where they're getting to. So, really exciting things for that band.
Over in the US, Cohen and Cambria have announced a US tour with Death Heaven, which would be an interesting evening. But also, they're going to be playing Good Apollo I'm Burning for Volume 2 in full, which I know Cohen and Cambria have very long titles. Let me just clarify to you, that is not 2005's album featuring Welcome Home and The Suffering and All Those Songs. This is the 2007 follow-up to it, which is not quite as like certified classic. Mark, would you be interested in seeing Cohen play that particular album?
Oh, yes, please. Like, I love that record. It's got some of the best and biggest songs on. Like, it's not seen as much as a classic as the two Coheed albums before it, but yeah, I'd be absolutely up for that. Seen a bit of Feathers, seen a bit of Radio Bye Bye. Come on.
It's got the Running Free on it, hasn't it? You know, like,
yeah, that's...
You see it's a lesser album, but it's got the Running Free on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one that a number of Coheed diehards, I'm sure, would absolutely go rabid for. And in the same night, they're going to see Death Heaven. So that is intriguing. And also, Obituary have just announced a US tour in support of their new album with Immolation, Blood Incantation, and Ingrown, the death metal tour of early 2023, for sure. And something that has kind of flown under the radar, because it's been such a busy week, but I feel like it shouldn't fly under the radar. I'm going to take
it should.
I'm going to take the moment to expose it to you all. If this had passed you by, Dave Ellefson's band, The Lucid, have released a cover of Faith No More's "Epic" under a alternate name, featuring Violent J.
I hate everything. This is just, I wish you hadn't made me aware of this. It just made me sad. Look, I've got no beef with Insane Clown Posse, you know. I'm like,
no, I admire them very much. Violet J is hilarious.
Yeah, no. I like but Dave Ellefson with Violet J covering "Epic" under the name Sweet Tooth. It's just not something I ever needed.
It's quite a fall of grace for Dave Ellefson, isn't it? Like,
really,
you played the bass line on P-Cells, and now you're here. Which, yeah, to clarify again, it's under an alternate name called Sweet Tooth, and the reason so is all of the vocal lines, essentially, and the vocal parts have been... They've crafted original versions for this. So you have the musical, you know, basis of Epic...
It's the Kid Rock treatment, essentially, isn't it?
Yeah, you hear that intro, and it's like, oh, good, I know what this is. And then before anything else, Violent J says his own name. Because Violent J always likes to slightly offset you and panic you before the verses then begin. What?
Oh, my God. It's horrible. Like, Epic doesn't have the best rap ever in it to begin with. But to make it worse, Violent J just sort of fumbles over it and, like, has this really annoying inflection in the first verse where he's talking about pain and just does that over and over.
The rap in Epic is, it's a very 80s style of rapping, but it's wicked to fucking listen to. This, like, you've taken it, you've made the melody and the rhythms and everything all worse. Congrats. Like, it already has a perfect chorus. This one, when this guy comes in, it's never going to catch on. Even people who hear this and enjoy it will instinctively revert to the original Epic chorus, having heard it enough times. What is the thinking behind this?
The new chorus is nothing. Like, I've heard this song a few times now because I was like, I need to, like...
You're a braver
there
man.
There is a chorus here, right? Like, but it just evaporates from my brain. And they have the fucking audacity near the end to play a little bit of the chorus from Epic. Not not all of it, though, just a little bit.
Yeah, like, you've taken a song that's very, very 80s. Like, The Real Thing is obviously completely brilliant, but there's a very, like, Bill and Ted feel to its kind of aesthetic and its feel, right? You know, the fashion.
Yeah.
And you've made it more dated by talking about, you know, breaking your balls or whatever. I was trying to find the lyrics and I couldn't. I was just trying to listen. But, I mean, Mike Heller from Fear Factory plays drums in this band as well. And it's like, oh, you just played drums on Shiki by Psy, session drummer for that. And within a year, you're on this. I mean,
maybe he's been paid well. I hope, like, he got...
Their EP, I didn't realise, their EP is out today, featuring this. It also has another single that features Violent J, an original song. And their guitarist said about Violent J, he added such a kick-ass and dangerous element to Saddle Up and Ride and Sweet Tooth. J has without a doubt taken the Lucid to another level.
I mean, you know what? Maybe he has elevated Lucid. His presence maybe has made this band better. Oh, I guess we'll find out.
So...
fair play for Dave Ellefson being on a song that features the line "dicks in your face."
So if you want to hear that, Sweet Tooth by The Lucid, it exists. Questions, I've just got a couple this time. We had fuckloads of news, but Arna Schrader asks, which bands are really great at writing both uplifting and depressing songs? One band came immediately to mind, and the more I thought about others, and did come up with in others, but the more I think there is not a more definitive answer than this, which is The Cure, because it's actually hilarious how much they typify and excel in those extremes, right? Like, on one hand, they're like the quintessential goth rock band, right? You know, when they were that. Disintegration is the quintessential yearning, you know, depressive bath of an album. Pornography, still to this day, is like a nightmarish, bleak, black abyss of a record, the really stark minimalist stuff that you get on the couple albums pre-Pornography. On the other hand, Friday, I'm in love, and yeah, you know, Just Like
the,
Heaven,
the bliss of that,
like the Love Cats songs, where if you don't smile the second they come in, I don't trust you. Like, this band made both Pornography and The Head on the Door. I don't know how much more blatant you can get.
Yeah, I think that is the best answer. Like, Touche Amore, I've always been one of those into kind of like a hard grunt who have like really sad upsetting songs and also quite kind of like driving, life affirming, uplifting ones on hardcore front. That's kind of one where my head went.
I you know, quick plug for the Patreon. My head immediately went to Jimmy Eat Your World.
Okay, yeah, that is a good one. Certainly.
Yeah, they have the big, you know, pop punk bangers, but also really delicate, beautiful, heartbroken, like piano led songs.
Yeah, the second band, what I thought you were going to say there is the second band that came to mind for me was Weezer, because on the one hand, all of their summery pop songs, but also, you know, jacked up hits and I'm Feeling Down.
Yeah, you know, they go from 303 to...
Weezer, there's too much weird stuff in between. Like...
I was also thinking Anathema, that they lean more on the, like, sort of beautiful and serene, but, you know, they have some really beautifully, like, heartbroken and sad moments. But you're right, The Cure, I didn't even think about them. I don't know how. That is the definitive answer, isn't it?
Yeah, literally first thing I thought of was like, oh, Disintegration and Friday, I'm in Love exist. I think similarly to The Cure, Type O Negative is one that I would raise, because like they've got pop songs that are super blissful and the most like gorgeous shit you've ever heard, you know, being wrapped up in like a candy floss blanket. They've got some of the angriest fucking material you will ever hear to like an almost problematic degree in the early days. They've got World Coming Down, which is some of the most bleakest, miserable shit ever. They've got songs that are like super fun and peppy but have dark lyrics and are attached to doom riffs like most of the last two albums. And then to go further down that kind of lineage, almost linking The Cure to where we go here, is an underrated one, I think, is Sabbath, because obviously we think of them as the band that kind of brought down the dark shadow of heavy metal, you know, at the end of the hippie dream. But they were still a 70s rock and roll band who enjoyed taking a lot of drugs. So a lot of their riffs and songs are a lot of fun, right? Like Sabracadabra, Supernaut. Like on the first album, you've got like Behind the Wall of Sleep and The Wizard. And they're so like upbeat and rocking. They're on there with the title track. Like Never Say Die is such a bop. And then you've got stuff like... Sorry, what?
Dirty women.
Dirty. It's celebratory, that's for sure.
Hey,
I was going to say,
it's fucking funkin'. It's great.
Yeah, I was going to say stuff like Planet Caravan as well is obviously quite. I find to be quite beautiful. So I think they're a bit of an underrated one because we all think of, you know, gloom.
You saying Type or Negative made me think him.
Yeah, weirdly, him are like the rare goth band that I think do more of the uplifting than they do the really miserable, because it's almost, it's kind of dark sexy more than it is dark, you know.
That's true.
I mean, well, they've got the one album.
Venus
Doom
is
like,
the one, yeah,
yeah. Like, where they go full, and then they follow that with
Screamworks, yeah.
Screamworks,
best album in the world.
And if Black Gaze as a kind of general style, I think in kind of post-punk is kind of capable of it, because I think like both Alcest and Death Heaven, you know, Death Heaven,
yeah,
have,
that's a great shout,
have Dream House, and then also something like Great Mass of Colour in different styles, both really gorgeous. And then stuff like New Bermuda, quite tormented, often that same album, actually got both. And, you know, Alcest have Shelter, and they have some really, really quite dark, yearning stuff as well. But The Cure is the answer. And Chris Bird asks, what is the best traditional setlist closer?
Surfacing, innit? Like, surfacing is there, like... Slipknot doing Surfacing and everyone doing the... Oh, no, not Surfacing. Surfacing and Spit It Out, both of them.
Surfacing is normally what they... It's Spit Out into Surfacing, but Surfacing does normally end the night. And I think that is... I mean, part of this was just making a list of all of the big metal bands and their one, right? Because, like, Surfacing at the end for Slipknot, I love that it's not necessarily our biggest song, but all you all know...
It's your new,
you know,
national anthem.
Your new national fucking anthem, and you know it's going to be there.
Yeah, no, that's it. It's whenever I just think of seeing Slipknot and Corey did... It's your new
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, fucking go.
Yeah. Right. I think just to go further down that list, like, I mean, In Waves secured its space there very well, even though on the latest tour they put it before Pull Harder. But, you know, Redneck.
Redneck is the other one I was about to say, yeah.
Yeah, they don't always do it, which I think puts out the question. But on the times they do, Blood and Thunder is one. I thought about one of the other places my mind went was Metallica, and they have, like, multiple, weirdly, depending on, like, what bit of their career it is, which maybe does put them out of the question. But, like, you know, when I got into Metallica, I always associated Seek and Destroy being in that slot, and that felt so right. When I got to actually seeing Metallica, it was Enter Sandman, and that's obviously, like, as big as you could possibly get as well. And now they've been moving that up to something else as well. But, I mean, so they have multiple answers for the question, weirdly, contradictorily. And the best possible, like, good time answer, Living After Midnight, Judas Priest. How are you going to feel anything but on top of the world when that is the last song of the night, every night?
Similar to that, I thought... Oh, sorry, go on.
Sorry, Mark, you do yours festival, yeah.
I thought of Denim and Leather, but...
that fucking rules. That's sick.
Yeah. Like, I was just going to just shout on a non-metal front, Buddy Holly, like, again, and The Middle. Like, any of us on those, if you just want the good time...
See, I did think about The Middle, but they don't always close on it, do they? Sometimes they...
And they kind of swap the sweetness sometimes. But when they drop out at the end of the set, it is just, you know... The good time closer. Like,
yeah, like Knights of Sidonia was always an important one for me, because, like, no matter what the Muse set is, end on that riff, and you and I must fight for our lives, like, the with the words coming up on screen and everything, like, that is such a release. I was trying to think about some ones that more people would know what I'm talking about, which we've gone through, but the very first one that I thought of, that I have thought about in the past as, like, is that the best one for me, is Empire Falls by Primordial, because they are this, like, incredibly, you know, rousing but often quite somber band, and then at the end they have this one absolute fucking heavy metal banger that is their most, like, obvious roar along chorus, and it's fucking phenomenal every time. And that to me is, like, the best possible thing to hear at the end. It fully sends you out the best way. And like some other kind of mid-level artists in that kind of range, again, Dreamhouse, Death Heaven.
Dreamhouse, I was just thinking, yeah, Dreamhouse.
Like,
when
you see the audience reaction, it's insane. Like, it's like they are playing Enter Sandman when that riff starts and people start running. It's fucking crazy. Funeralopolis, Electric Wizard, is always the most crushing at the end. And I think my favourite answer next to Empire Falls, personally, is Chant for Eschaton by Behemoth, because... it has stayed there all these years, but if you've seen Behemoth on a big stage, the way that song has survived with them to become even bigger, like, sometimes in a song like that that's kind of the traditional closer, you want that kind of anticipation at the start of it of, like, this is the last chance to go, and the build-up of that lead line at the start, you know, and getting faster and faster, and then it booting off, like, it's one of my very favourite live music moments. Like, it takes my breath away every time. And then the ending when it crunches and the pyro starts going ape shit, like, it's the one.
I've got a couple more to the pop-punk emo thing that just popped in my head. One of them I kind of forgot because they don't, very occasionally they'll move it, which is Came Out Swinging. But when the one used to have that as a closer, it is the most euphoric end. And the other one is Welcome to the Black Parade. As, like, just thinking about how much that got me seeing that at Milton Keynes and like that. It's just what a magical moment it is.
I just want to shout out Dashboard Confessional. Always end on Hands Down. And Chris always intros it with, "This is a song about the best day of my life." That's really nice. I love Newfound Glory ending with My Friends Over You, because that's the best pop punk song
basically ever, yeah.
But my favourite is Warning, Skindred. Like,
okay, yeah,
you know what you're going to get.
It's, it's certainly got a moment associated with it,
yeah,
hasn't
exactly
it?
You get the Newport helicopter and you end the set on absolute carnage, and it, you know, that's a fucking banger of a song, and you get a genuinely, like, iconic moment with it.
Yeah, good answer. For Patreon supporters, you will see that album clubs are back in swing now for the new year. We've just recorded and uploaded our newest batch of them yesterday. Myself, Sam and Elliot went into 4 very conversation-worthy albums from Linkin Park, Primus, Iron Age and Mortician. Sam, I know that your particular pick was the maybe more divisive one, but in general, were there highlights there for you?
It was a good fun batch. Like I say, the Iron Age record, going back to that and just kind of going, oh yeah, this band are just crush. Awesome. Mortician was just the source of much hilarity for how just caveman brain stupid that band are. And Primus sucks.
Yeah, I had so much fun revisiting Salem Caesar Cheese. Like, I hadn't listened to Primus properly in quite a while, and fucking hell, like, that record is so great. But, I mean, the Mortician chat is everything that I wanted to have about a Mortician chat. It was so much fun. Some great stories involved with that. Influential records all around to this day. To hear that right now, patreon.com/thatsnotmetal is where to go. Your support is really important to us, and it's super appreciated for all of you who do come over. We've got plans for a TNN's Horror and the first part of our upcoming Bleeding Through band special over the next couple of weeks. Release roundup. Last week, just because we weren't doing a hyperblast there, some other stuff that we didn't review that did come out. Maneskin's long-awaited debut album. Is it a debut album? Probably isn't, actually. Fuck no.
I don't think it is. It's like their first big album.
Their first album since people knew who they are. It's called Rush. It's out now. It's like nearly an hour long. I'm not going to listen to. I'm not going to listen to that.
I'll get around to it at some point, I reckon.
No, I don't think I will. Consider whether it was worth reviewing or not. Decided probably not. But a notable release nonetheless. Newfound Glory released an acoustic album called Make the Most of It. I assumed it was just going to be like reworkings of old Newfound Glory songs in an acoustic fashion. Mark, you ever being the person who keeps us up to date on what fucking nonsense Newfound Glory are up to and putting out, you inform me that it's half of it is new material. So, like, is it any good?
You know what? A couple songs on I do quite like, because they sound like your traditional Newfound Glory pop-punk banger, but acoustic. And you know, the back half, it's always nice to hear All Downhill From Here and Hit and Miss. Ultimately, like, the sentiment of the songs is very real and it's very raw and emotional, but because you have a cartoon character delivering those lyrics, you might as well have just made them pop punk songs. Like, the actual emotional impact of it wouldn't have been lessened.
Acoustic Jordan Pundick album, I think, particularly. I'm going to skip that one as well. Riverside, kind of a long-going now prog act, ID Identity. Tidal Wave, The Lord Knows. This is for your stoner fans if you want some big amplifier worship going on. German black metal, Imperium Decadens, Into Sorrow Evermore. We had a couple of death metal records last year as well. The one I would recommend is Nothingness with Supraliminal. Very stinky stuff going on there. And it's on Everlasting Spew Records, which is very, very good. But the album is worthwhile. We also had one from Dayquisitor called Apotheosis, and Dryad, The Abyssal Plane, for something a little bit more blackened. And there was also a record on 20 Bucks Spin, I believe, from a band called Tribunal called The Weight of Remembrance, which is more your kind of goth metal, slightly kind of peacefully inspired, interesting stuff going on there. This week's releases, the one to shout out that we did review last week but is out now is the one from Grief Symposium, that's In the Absence of Light. That was the kind of Death Doom record from members of The King is Blind, so go and listen to that out on Church Road. Fucked Up, One Day, so titled because it is their album that they put together in one day. Again, that idea, it's inherently a little interesting, but also maybe inherently a little, I don't know how good this can really be. White Reaper, some kind of garage punk stuff going on there. Their album's called Asking for a Ride. Sightless Pit, Lockstep Blood War. This is the second album from the underground metal kind of collective, made up of members of Full of Hell and The Body. Their last record also featured Lingua Ignota on vocals, Kristen Hayter. She is not a part of this one as her ongoing kind of Lingua Ignota wind down, which is both understandable and a bit of a shame in terms of maybe what this could be compared to the first record, but I'm sure it'll be interesting to see nonetheless. Oozing Wound, We Cater to Cowards, that's some kind of really weird like crossover going on there. And Oceans, As in Gardens, So in Tombs, that's some kind of proggy black doom symphonic stuff happening. Bizarre Cult, that's just Bizarre Cult obviously, but you want to know how to spell it. Den Tapter Kriegen, that is some black gaze. Trastorned, Into the Void, a couple of records here actually are on a label that I quite enjoy for kind of your old school metal vibes. That's called Dying Victims Productions. Trastorned's record Into the Void is more kind of like black thrash from Chile. And there's also on that same label Free Road, Do What You Feel with an exclamation mark, which is much more like 70s kind of good time rock stuff. And last of all is, as I learned earlier, just hours before doing this, is the Lucid's EP, Saddle Up and Ride, should be out as well. Thank you for listening here on That's Not Metal. I don't know if next week will be quite as insanely busy as this one, but we will be back to cover the week's developments regardless and keep you posted on the cool new stuff that's coming out as well. Album clubs on Linkin Park's A Thousand Suns, Primus Sailing the Seas of Cheese, Iron Age and Mortician at patreon.com/thatsnotmetal. Loads more to come. If you like what you do, it'd be great as well if you considered taking the moment to hop on over to iTunes or wherever it is you listen to us and leave us a nice star rating and a review as well. Thank you very much. See you next time.
What was that record label? Everlasting Spew.